Accession number 32297, reel 12.
John Dixon, reel 12. John, you were mentioning the commander who taught you unarmed combat, and then you'd remembered his name.
That's right, I've just remembered. I think his name was Commander Manser. I think it was spelled M-A-N-S-S-S-E-R-G-H. But anyway, just an additional bit of information for you.
What happened after you'd finished the course at Greenwich?
Well, would you believe it? We all got on the train, I think. We went back up to Bootle, up to Macaw. You see, nobody seemed to quite know where we were going or what they wanted to do with us. And if there'd been an emergency somewhere, obviously we'd have been rushed off. But there was no sort of panic to get us flying operationally. So we went back to Bootle. But I think, luckily, we were probably there a week or 10 days at the most. And then their lordships of the Admiralty decided, quite wisely, I think, that as we hadn't flown for 3 months, we needed a refresher course. So off we got on another train. This time we went further north still, and we ended up at Errol, which is just outside Dundee, just to the west of Dundee. It is now Dundee City Airport. But when we went there, Errol, and it was back to the RAF, because it was an RAF-run school called Number 9, brackets P, closed brackets AFU, which P for pilots, AFU, Advanced Flying Unit. So that's where we went.
Was this to familiarise you again with British conditions and familiarise those people who hadn't trained in Britain on flying in the UK?
Yes, I think the answer was, as I said, it was a refresher course. It was a flying school, but, I mean, basically the instructor didn't have to teach us to fly. We knew that. They were there really and truly, I think, to make sure we hadn't developed any bad habits. And they just checked us out on those sort of things. We did night flying, we did instrument flying, but it was really on a much more friendly sort of basis, just to make sure we were au fait with present conditions, as it were. And the other thing was, they said that it was partly to get us used to British layout cockpits, rather than the American style cockpits. Very little difference, really. But if I can remember, the power settings in an American aeroplane, it's registered in inches of mercury as the pressure that goes onto the throttle. I'm not a mechanical man, so I can't explain it, but it's registered in inches, whereas a British aeroplane, it's pounds per square inch. So, you know, maximum power may be 8 pounds, or in an American it might be 26 inches. And there were slight differences in the actual way the instruments worked, but it was no great problem.
What type of aircraft were you training on?
Well, we had Miles Masters, which were made at Reading, I think. That was the head of where the company was, Miles Aircraft. A very, very nice little aeroplane. It was a low-wing monoplane. It had a Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine, an inline engine. So you could quite easily or almost say it was like a mini Spitfire in a way, perhaps a little about the same size as a Spitfire, but a nice wide undercarriage, retractable undercarriage, flaps, everything there. Two seats, of course, pupil in the front, instructor in the back. And it was quite a nippy little aeroplane. Did I say Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine? That's right. But we also had, interestingly enough, there was another master there, the Miles Master 2, which was the same aeroplane exactly, except it didn't look quite as nice because they'd taken the Rolls-Royce Kestrel engine out and put a Bristol Mercury engine in, which is a radial engine. which I think they were surplus to the things they used to have in Bristol plenums and things, and they needed to use them up. Anyway, it made the master, say, not quite as good-looking, but certainly as powerful, and probably a little bit faster. I'll go a step further. There was a third mark of master, the Mars Master 3, where they put an American engine in the Pratt & Whitney Wasp, which was the same sort of engine as we'd had in the Harvard. But we didn't have any of those, so I never flew a Master 3.
What was the weather like when you arrived there?
Good. Oh, it was good. It was pleasant, I suppose. It was about March now, March 1944. And it was, you know, altogether a very pleasant time. The other interesting thing I'm trying to remember is that when you had an instructor with you, no matter what his rank was, he was always Sir. He always referred to your instructor as Sir. Well, now here we were in a situation. All right, I was only a very lowly midshipman, but I was an officer, and most of our instructors were sergeants or flight sergeants. So did we call them Sir? I think we got round it by just calling one another by our Christian names. It was a very happy, sort of relaxed atmosphere. We were there for a month. While I was there, I had my one claim to fame, I think, when I had to do a landing without wheels or flaps, which was I learned a big lesson from that.
What happened?
Well, we were due to go night flying, and every time you went night flying, the aircraft that were going to be used had to have a little test, an air test, in the daytime, just to check everything au fait for the night flying. And this instructor, I think he was a sergeant, Sergeant Stabler, I remember looking at the logbook, he came in and he said, oh, so-and-so, the number of the aircraft, wants an air test. Well, me being as keen as mustard, before he could say who would do it, I was out there. I'd got my parachute in the cockpit, I got my helmet, and I just climbed in. The flight was going to take quarter of an hour at the most. So off I went. Obviously I must have signed a book or something just to say I'd taken it, but I was airborne before anybody else had really woken up to the fact that there was a plane to fly. I couldn't wait to fly, that's the simple answer. Anyway, did all the air tests, no problems, all the checks and everything, came back into the circuit to land. Problem: the wheels wouldn't come down. Well, that's odd. I thought we need wheels to land this aeroplane. Anyway, they wouldn't come down. So I went through all the emergency drills. Still no joy. The flaps wouldn't work. So I realised that there was a hydraulic failure somewhere. But I don't remember there was any gauge in the cockpit. There may have been, but I can't remember to actually indicate what the hydraulic pressure was. Later aeroplanes had all these sophisticated things. But anyway, there was no way I could tell what was causing the problem. Anyway, I called up the base and told them I'd got this problem, and they then instructed me to do this, do that. And one of the things that you have to do is dive the aeroplane as fast as you can, select the undercarriage down, and then haul back on the stick so that the force of gravity will... or the G-force will unlock the wheels. None of that worked, none of that worked. So I had to accept that I was going to have to land the thing without wheels. So I told them all this, and they said, well, you'll have to land on the grass, but before you do that, go away and fly round and use up the fuel, because they didn't want a tank full of fuel when I actually hit the ground, as it were. So off I went. And the gorgeous evening, and I just stooged round looking at all the gorgeous countryside, and the Scottish countryside at that time of the year was wonderful. So I thoroughly enjoyed the flight, but as I had rushed off the ground in such a hurry, I had neglected to do what you should always do, a call of nature. So I hadn't. And I was getting very, very frustrated in this aeroplane. And as far as I remember, there was no way that you could possibly relieve the situation because they didn't have the toilet facilities in a master. And I was wearing my uniform. I hadn't put any flying clothes on or battle dress or anything. I was just wearing my uniform. And I thought, well, I can't soil this, can I? Anyway, I managed to contain myself, and I think I was in the air for 2 hours, which is a long time, until it was pretty obvious I hadn't got a lot of fuel left, so I told them, and by then it's just getting dusk. So I said, well, I can come and land now, can I? And they said yes. No problem at all, just switch the engine off, switch the fuel off as you come across the boundary of the airfield, hold it off above the grass and just let it bang down onto the grass, or make sure your straps are completely tight, hood open, and there was clouds of dust and smoke and everything, and the plane gently slid to a halt, you see. The next thing I'm aware of, the ambulance and the fire engine and everything came chasing up the runway beside me to make sure that I was going to be okay if the plane had turned over or anything. When they got there, no sign of me at all. Well, you can imagine what I was doing. And so, big lesson learned, never ever take off, and this applies today, even when I go in an airliner, always make sure you're comfortable before you take off.
Was there any repercussions about the landing? Did you have to attend a board of inquiry or anything like that?
Oh, well, I had to fill in. There's the usual form you have to fill in. No, wait a minute. The Navy had a form. I had to fill out my A25, that's right. There's an Admiralty form A25, which you have to complete every time you have an accident, however minor, even if you just scrape a wingtip. An A25. Now, whether they had the same form in the RAF, I'm not sure. But obviously, I had to make a report. But what did please me was they seemed to think that I behaved in a very calm and gentle way of dealing with the situation. No panic, and that's a, so they endorsed my logbook with a nice green endorsement to say that I'd behaved myself very well. So this more or less cancelled out the red one I'd had in Canada.
But is it something, in those occasions, is it something that in a sense does help you, because it shows that you've learnt all your lessons and that you can handle a situation like that?
Well, I suppose so. I suppose so, Richard, yeah. I mean, I didn't have any fears about landing the thing. I mean, I'd made up my mind to turn the fuel off, switch the engine off, and so that the propeller was basically had stopped by the time I hit the ground. And believe it or not, that same aeroplane was repaired and back in the air in 3 days. So I couldn't have done too much harm to it.
You say that you were there for a month.
Yes.
What happened next after that period?
Well, this was the rather sad time. At the end of the month, of course, we all of us who'd been together probably for 16 months now, we're not all bosom pals, but we were all buddies, rather like being at school. You've got your mates, and we had all our mates, but we all went off in separate directions. I don't know quite what I was expecting to do next, but of course a lot of the lads were hoping to be fighter pilots, and flying the masters was the step towards that. So probably half of the course, and that wouldn't have been more than perhaps 15 or 20 lads, they went off down to Yeovilton in Somerset, where they learnt to fly fighters. Two or three of the very lucky ones of that group got to fly the American Hellcats and the Corsairs, which is a smile in itself because they were back on American cockpits and American instruments. But No, they were the very lucky ones. They got onto there. All the others of the fighter boys, I think, ended up on Sea Fires, which was, all right. But I mean, they were never built for operating at sea. They did well enough, but they weren't quite the same as the American planes. Then there was six or seven of others who, believe it or not, while we were at Errol, they didn't fly Masters. They started flying Swordfish. And having trained on Harvards in Canada, low wing, fairly nippy, fast monoplanes, there they were flying Swordfish, 90 knots maximum, old biplanes built in 1934. Most people know what a Swordfish looks like. And I thought this was a huge backward step for those lads. And I don't know whether they did or not, but there they were flying Swordfish. And they ended up on the escort carriers, mainly on the Arctic convoys in 1944-1945, and I've got one chum from that lot who I'm still in touch with. The others went on to the MAC ships, the merchant aircraft carriers, and that was a different sort of world, and I've got one of my chums who did that. And the rest of us, what do we do? Nobody quite seemed to know what was going to happen to us. There was always the risk, I suppose, that you were going to end up as a second line pilot, doing rather menial tasks, as we thought. But it was quite a worrying sort of period, not quite knowing what was going to happen to you then. And of course, you were saying goodbye to all your mates who you've been with all this time. If I could just go back a little bit into Errol, there was one of my particular chums, a chap called Johnny Hobday, who was killed while we were at Errol. He was the first one of our group who lost his life, and he was doing a night flying exercise one night with his instructor, who was a RAF sergeant, if I remember, the plane just crashed into the River Tay, and they found afterwards the reason for the crash, they said, was because it got iced up. Well, this was the end of March, and there were some cold weather, but anyway, they said he got iced up and they got out of control or something. And it was the aeroplane that he crashed in. I'd been flying myself 2 days earlier, so it just shows you this is the sort of thing that can happen.
What happened to your group then, the ones who had been neither Swordfish nor fighter pilot?
Neither fish nor fowl. Well, my particular chum, Graham, we know he went off and flew out to Trinidad or Jamaica, wherever it was, ferrying observers, trainee observers, so he had a pretty menial job. And others, I don't know whether they went target towing or fleet requirements units or those sort of jobs, or even not transport pilot, the ferry pilot doing that sort of job, which was seemed a bit of a waste having gone through all that training. I was left on my own, and nobody seemed to know what was going to happen to me, and I was obviously anxious and feeling very, very lonely. You can imagine, as a 19-year-old, suddenly you've lost all your mates, and you seem to be a bit spare. Anyway, if you want me to go on to the next step, I was then sent to a place called Hinstock, Royal Naval Air Station Hinstock, which is in Shropshire, near a town called Market Drayton, which I suppose where I went by train. Can't remember, but I must have arrived somewhere by train. And what were they going to do with me there? You wouldn't believe this. I was going to become an instructor on instrument flying. The aircraft they flew there were Airspeed Oxfords, twin engine trainers, rather like driving a bus. And there was me, a very junior midshipman, and that the idea was that I would be trained as an instructor, and senior pilots who'd done a stint overseas or whatever, who needed to be refreshed on instrument flying, would come to Hinstock, and I would have to teach them all about instrument flying and flying the beam and all that sort of thing. The only good thing about it, Richard, was I learnt to fly a twin-engined aeroplane, which was fairly rare in the Navy in 1944. There weren't too many twin-engine pilots, so that was a plus. But it was, I was so miserable and so unhappy. One reason was that the other instructors on this outfit were all, in my eyes, old men. In fact, some had flown before the war as pilots on Jersey Airways, and they really were long in the tooth. Most of them were married, and they lived off the base. So there was no social life for young midshipmen. And I really was completely like a fish out of water. I didn't like the job. I didn't like the fact that I was lonely, and I was lonely. Plus the fact that at that time, and it was, what, April 1944, everything was building up in the south of England. We knew that the D-Day preparations were going on. Obviously, we didn't know the details. But there was me, stuck up in Shropshire, flying Oxfords round, and I didn't think this was at all what I'd been trained for.
How did you get rated on the Oxford? How did that occur? Because you'd only flown on single engines before, hadn't you? So was there a process of...
One or two of the senior bodies taught me how to fly it, obviously. I mean, it was a dual control, side by side. And you had just a few different procedures to learn, basically, what happened if one engine failed and that sort of thing. But it was really just like driving a bus, and it was just completely boring in my view. I never got to actually instruct anybody. I didn't actually get to the point of having somebody come and me telling them how to fly the instruments and how to fly the beam and all that sort of thing. Because I was only there, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks, I think. Not much more. And somebody, thank goodness, took pity on me and realised I was like a fish out of water. So I was taken away from there. And so where did I go? Back to Errol. Except that's not quite true. Errol, which was just outside Dundee, had a satellite airfield which was called Findo Gask. Nobody's ever heard of it much, but if you look on a map you'll see that about 8 miles west of Perth was this place called Findo Gask, and it was a lovely part of the country, lovely. So that's where I was put into this sort of satellite airfield. Again, Mars Masters, there was the odd swordfish there, and I managed to get the odd ride in a swordfish just for fun. I didn't want to get involved in it, as you can understand. But it was just like a little holiday, really. It was just 2 or 3 weeks holiday.
What was your kind of role there?
Just having a good time, I think. I didn't need any instruction because I'd been through it all. And I think we did a bit of night flying and anything that was to keep me amused.
So it's almost like marking time here, are you? You're just waiting
really,
for the...
Yeah, looking back on it, yes. I was obviously marking time. And of course, all my old pals had moved on, but there were a few more similar-minded people to me. So it was quite a pleasant two or three weeks, that's all. And then, thank heavens, I suddenly got a notice that I was being posted to 812 Naval Air Squadron. Now, I had no idea what 812 Naval Air Squadron was going to be doing or flying, but the joy of joy to me was that it was a squadron starting with the number 8, and all operational squadrons, first-line squadrons, were all 8s. I'll add a little bit to that in a minute, but... So I knew I was going to be in an operational squadron, but I couldn't tell you what sort, what I'd be flying, just that I was going to this squadron, and I had to report to Royal Naval Air Station Streatham, which is near Warrington in Cheshire. And it was the squadron was being reformed on the 1st of June 1944, and that's where I had to go. Just backtracking a little bit, when I said all operational squadrons begin with a letter, begin with a figure 8, which is true, there were a few others. Some of the American squadrons that were squadrons flying American aircraft that were formed up in America by people training out there had the number starting 18, so we got numbers like 1840, 1839 and all this, and these were mainly the Corsair and the Hellcat squadrons, and then there were three other squadrons operational during World War II that started with the number 17, so you had 1770, 1771, 1772, and they were the squadrons flying Fairey Fireflies, which were the British two-seat fleet fighters with cannon and that sort of thing. Nice aeroplanes. So,
what did the non-operational squadrons?
Sorry?
What were the non-operational squadrons numbered as?
Well, they were normally 700. They all started with the number 7. Again, one slight correction on that. In the old days, when I say the old days, at the beginning of the war, when you had walrus and things being catapulted off cruisers and battleships, they were in a squadron. It may have been 700 or 700 and something or other. So you couldn't exactly say they were non-operational, but they weren't. They didn't operate as complete squadrons as we did.